I was wondering this week, and the topic of healing was on my brain. I was wondering what it would be like for the earth to be healed. And you know, in the Old Testament, a very common association is the forgiveness of sin and actual healing of the bodies. Like in Psalm 103, the psalmist says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgiveth all thine iniquities, who healeth all thy diseases." Or over in Isaiah 1:3-24, he looks forward to the day when the inhabitants shall not say, "I am sick," and the people there that dwell therein shall be forgiven of their iniquities. Because there's this kind of idea and there's kind of this connection between a God who cares about our brokenness, our spiritual brokenness, our physical brokenness, our emotional brokenness, and a God that wants to heal. And that's why Jesus came. Healing was a central part of his message. As a matter of fact, it was one of the signs of this Messiah that when he comes, that healing would come also. And healing is not something that Jesus did just to attract big crowds. It was a sign that in Jesus, God's work to heal brokenness has begun. And so we're going to look today at a story of the calling of Matthew. Matthew, in the Gospel of Matthew, which was written almost primarily to the Hebrew reader, it has significance to the Hebrew reader that it wouldn't have had to the Gentile reader of the day. The Gospel of Mark, and we'll get into that in future sermons, but the Gospel of Mark had a lot more application for the Gentile reader. But in the Gospel of Matthew, you see healing story after healing story after healing story, and right in the middle of it, Matthew 8 and 9, you have one story after another, the healings of the lepers, of the paralytics, of the demon-possessed, of the blind, of the mute, of the sick girl, the dead girl, the centurion's servant. And Jesus went preaching the good news of the gospel of the kingdom, healing every disease, every sickness. And then right here, right in the middle of it, right in the middle of the stories about healing diseases, is the story of the calling of Matthew. Matthew. And as Jesus passed forth from thence, from there, a place where he just healed a paralytic person, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the receipt of customs, and he saith unto him, "Follow me." And he arose, and he followed him. Now, the story of the calling of Matthew is actually in the section of healing for a deliberate reason. Matthew's actually putting it in here for a deliberate reason. He's saying, and just who wrote the book of Matthew? Well, it's Matthew, right? And so he's kind of like sitting there saying, "I was one of these people that got healed. My life was kind of drab." I mean, because we know that Matthew was this kind of sketchy tax collector with scandalous friends. And he had come to Jesus and he's saying, "I got healed, not so much for me and my body, but my conscience was weighed down with guilt because I had done some bad things. My heart was kind of sick. I was isolated from my countrymen. My soul was empty. And Jesus changed all that. I'm one of the people that Jesus healed." That's why Matthew's in here. And then we see that Matthew throws this feast with all of his friends, all of his sketchy little friends, tax collectors, sinful, scandalous friends come, and his disciples, and the Pharisees and the religious leaders are there, and they're looking at it, and they're all troubled because they believe that by eating and having a feast with these kinds of people that you're going to make yourself ceremoniously unclean, and that Jesus, as a rabbi, is implicitly endorsing this kind of lifestyle. He's soft on sin. And a lot of what Jesus does is heal people. And the religious leaders are upset about this, and they tell their disciples. And when Jesus hears this, this is what he says. Matthew chapter 9, verse 12. And it's critical for us as we think about healing. Brother Rich mentioned about the sins that are prevalent and that we got to fight for the bean fields of our life. Every single one of us do. Every single one of us need healing. And maybe by now, you've already figured out we're going to be talking about healing today, so your mind is kind of just like tuning Brother John out. There's so much better things to do, like I'm just one shot away from prestiging on Call of Duty. You know, you got that kind of thing going on in your brain. Give me your mind a second. Because I hope by the end of this message we can figure out something. Whether we're 12, 24, or 84, we all need, to some degree, healing. And the story that Jesus tells us is kind of earth-shattering. And so we're going to think about for a moment, what does it mean to be healed? And what would it look like for us to be a healing community as a church? Matthew chapter 9, verse 12. And when Jesus heard that about the Pharisees kind of being critical because he was hanging out with sinners, when Jesus heard that, he said unto him, "They that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick." So Jesus gives an almost a one-sentence parable why he is on earth. And there's three characters in it. And if you don't mind, I'm going to utilize this visual here. There are three characters here. There's the doctor. Then there's the healthy people. And then there are the sick people. So it's not a real complicated story at this point, but these are the three characters involved. And who's the doctor in this story? It's Jesus. Jesus is the doctor, Dr. Jesus. One character is the doctor, one character is the sick, one character is the healthy. Jesus is the doctor. Okay, so who are the sick in this story? Well, the sick are the sinners. The sick are the sinners, and the people sitting there at the table, they are the tax collectors, they are sick. What are they like? How are we to think about them? Well, they're needy people. They're spiritually hurting people. Things aren't going well for these people, so they turn to other ways to try to feed themselves. Things aren't working out. These people right here, things aren't working out. They're spiritually needy. Here's another thing about the sick people. They're really in tune with their pain. They know that they're hurting. They're humble. They don't expect to get respect. They don't expect godly people to hang out with them. They don't expect somebody like Jesus to be with them or to eat with them or really even care about them. Those are the sick people. People like Matthew have been shunned over the years by his countrymen. Women who have turned to prostitution in order to put food on the table for their family. Sick people. And then there are the healthy people. And who are the healthy people in this story? Well, they're the Pharisees. The people who are, quote, spiritually healthy. The religious leaders. And what are they like? How are we to think about them? What are they like? Well, to tell you the truth, they're kind of proud. They really think that they're doing pretty good spiritually. They really think that they don't need very much from anybody, especially someone like Jesus. They tend to be kind of distant. And now they may have a lot of relationships, but the reality is even though they use the right words and they'll say things like, oh, God is gracious and I need forgiveness. They say the right language, but when you're around them, you don't feel that. And when you're with them, you kind of feel like, I wouldn't really want to open up to one of these people. I wouldn't want to share my life and my struggles. I don't feel very safe around them. I feel like they're probably going to judge me. So another thing about the healthy people is not always widely known is that the healthy people also tend to be kind of hidden. As a matter of fact, addressing these same group of people at another time, Jesus looks at them and he says, you know, you're like a bunch of whited sepulchers. Now, as King James English kids, what that means is you're like a bunch of white tombs. You're real polished on the inside. I mean, you're real polished on the outside. But on the inside, you're filled with dead men's bones. Oh, sure. You don't smoke. You don't drink. You don't dance. You don't cuss. You don't watch South Park. You're doing all the right things, Kyle. But on the inside, you're filled with dead men's bones. Because they're judging themselves by some mythical standard. So what does Dr. Jesus come when he says? Because another question is, who did the doctor come for? And this is what Jesus says. Jesus says, I came for the sick. Who did the doctor not come for? He says, I did not come for the healthy. I didn't come for these guys right here. That's kind of interesting. Another question, which category are you in? Because I think a lot of us want to be in the category of people that Jesus actually came for, right? I want to be in that group that Jesus came for. But in order to be in the group that Jesus came for, what do you have to recognize about yourself? You're sick. You're spiritually needy. You're hurting. You don't have it all together. You don't have all the answers. I want to be in the Jesus came for me group, but while being needy, being humble, being in touch with my pain, but I kind of want to be in that group right there. I kind of want to be one of the healthy people, one of the people that have it all together. Sounds kind of more appealing to me. And churches, we talked about institutions. Churches can kind of get a bit strange over time period. We recognize intellectually that we're kind of spiritual hospitals as a church, that we exist to minister to the hurting, to spread the good news of the gospel of the finished work of Jesus Christ to a hurting world. And we don't attach strings to it, and we don't make it a performance-based religion. We preach the good news that in Christ alone is the only hope of the world. And that's our mission, right? And so we're supposed to minister to these people as a church, but we kind of want to be in this group right here, and we kind of like to think of ourselves as healthy people, but at the end of the day, we're still all kinds of sick people. We get strange. Over a period of time, we kind of think that there are a lot of people in this group helping people in that group, and we tend to forget we're all in this group right here. Well, anyway, another question is, well, what disease do the sick people suffer from? Well, Jesus is actually kind of quite clear about this. He says the doctor comes for the sick and not for the healthy. That the people who are sick, the people who think they're righteous, he's kind of, I've come for sinners. And he says that the disease that we're all suffering from, the disease that we're all suffering from is sin. Every one of us has a disease. And I want to talk about this disease of sin for the remainder of the message, because it's so pervasive and it's so harmful. And in the culture that we live in, we can have some messed up misunderstandings about sin, because quite frankly, the American culture in the year 2012 is a therapeutic culture where we're all about feeling good about ourselves, and we don't really want to call sin sin, and we have some things that burden us. But we're, as a therapeutic culture, we like to talk about the scars of our lives, the hurts that we carried around, and we do all have those. And it's good to be open about them. But the core and the problem that we face is not the scars that we carry around and the hurts that have been inflicted upon us. The core problem is not the external issues. The core problem is an internal issue, and that core problem is called sin. And it threatens us. So now, to understand how powerful sin is, and what a powerful disease it is, and why we cannot manage it ourselves, and why we need a doctor, why we need help, I want to look at three different levels of sin, because it's a really complex phenomenon. I kind of want to start at the surface level, because sinful acts, let's talk about sinful acts to begin with, because there's a lot of particular behaviors I engage in that are sins. I cheat on a test, I gossip about somebody, I yell at somebody, I lust. I have issues like that. And maybe these aren't issues that are... I hurt a sibling. I inflict pain on a brother or sister. We are sinful creatures from birth. So the very root problem of sin, sinful acts, let's look at the nature of sinful acts to begin with. Now, part of the power of sin is the power that it blinds us to how bad it is. And the primary tool that we use against sin is not virtue. Honestly, the primary tool that we use against sin is denial. It's not, you know, it's not as bad as that. It's a... anybody here? I mean, there was a guy by the name of Matt Barkus who did this study, and he was studying human conditions, and he said, on average, people deceive themselves or say deceitful things about 100 times a day. That's kind of staggering if you think about it. I mean, and after I read that, I'm like, I'm going to kind of do a self-test on that one, right? Because, you know, the first thing I said is, I don't think I said sinful thing. Ooh, hey, you know, one. Right there, you know. We do this without even thinking about it. And sometimes it's just language that comes out of us, and we're not even really terribly conscious about it. Somebody says, you know, you're late to a meeting. Oh, I'm sorry I'm late. Traffic was bad. We can't just admit, hey, you know, I didn't care enough about you to get up and get there on time. We spin, we hype, we shade by our gestures, by our words. Barna Group, the Barna Group did this survey on what are the top five temptations that people face. And they did this nationwide poll. What are the top five temptations you face? And I want you to hear what people listed. Number one temptation that people face, worry. I'm tempted to worry too much. I guess I'll just have to confess that I need to trust God more. Worry. Number two, procrastination. That's a really bad temptation. Sometimes I just put things off. Number three temptation in America, people listed. Sometimes I eat too much. Ooh. Number four. Well, I guess I just have to confess that I use social media too much. Number five, I can be a little bit lazy. Does that list seem a little bit soft to anybody? Let me tell you what the Word of God says. This is the Word of God, Romans chapter 3, verse 10 through 18. By way of contrast, this is what God says. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Their tongue is an open sepulcher. Their tongues have been used for deceit. The poison of asps is upon their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing, bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. That's the prophetic witness about the human condition. That's God's word. And we read stuff like that, and we'll pick and we'll choose out of that man who he's talking about, who could be, and we have a hard time accepting this diagnosis. In our culture, we have largely prescribed kind of this alternative solution to the human condition. The alternative solution to the human condition is we just don't have enough self-esteem. We don't feel good about ourselves. We just need to raise everybody's self-esteem a little bit. Tell kids they can do everything. Tell everybody gets an A. Everybody gets a trophy. Nobody should feel badly. All problems are a result of low self-esteem. As a matter of fact, there is a state in the United States that has a self-esteem task force. California. Right. Because that's the problem. Now, some of y'all that are a little bit older are going to remember this. 20 years ago, one of the number one songs, and it stayed on the radio forever. I just wanted to pull my eyeballs out every time I heard it. I can't stand this song. And it's written by a DeKalb County resident, Whitney Houston. Let me read you the lyrics of the chorus. Y'all will remember this. I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadow. If I fail, if I succeed, at least I lived as I believe. No matter what they take from me, they can't take away my dignity, because the greatest love of all, it's happening to me. I found the greatest love of all inside of me. The greatest love of all. It's easy to achieve, learning to love yourself. It's the greatest love of all. Are you kidding me? Lady Gaga's message, there's a song out, baby, you're born a superstar, don't die loving me more, love yourself more. That's the message of our culture. Now, I want you to juxtapose what Whitney Houston said, the greatest love of all is loving yourself, versus what Jesus says is that greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. We face a problem in our culture. I would venture to say that there is never a time in human history until this generation when someone could get away with singing a song that says, the greatest love of all is learning to love yourself. I mean, can you imagine William Shakespeare writing Romeo and Romeo? Seriously. It is so ingrained in our culture. It's a culture of entitlement. We don't want to face the hard condition because it is kind of hard. Sin is hard. Sin is hard. And what has increased sharply in our day is the problem of narcissism. People feeling increasingly entitled to high grades. People feeling just entitled to lots of money when they go into the workforce, not being able to enter the workforce very healthy because it's kind of a shock to their little systems that you're not entitled to an automatically $100,000 job the moment you enter the workforce. You actually have to put in some time. You actually have to work at it. And this is what James says. Children kind of growing up not knowing what's acceptable and what boundaries are. The language of the Bible is just so foreign to us. James chapter 1, verse 21. Wherefore, lay apart all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness. And we look at things like that. James is saying, lay aside. And listen to me. He's talking to children of God. And he's saying, children of God, lay aside all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness. Filthiness. We hear words like that. It's like, what about me is filthy? We can theologically and intellectually say, yeah, I'm sick. I understand grace and all that. But we really honestly feel we're kind of over in this group right here, if we're really honest about it. And that's what that's what entitles us to feel self-righteous when we compare ourselves to other people. A really good exercise, and one that I try and do with increasing regularity because it attacks everybody, is when I hear something being said critically about another person, I try to think, yeah, I could probably do that too. I'm not above doing that because I too am a sinner. But the problem with being over here in this group right here is you forget your need for Jesus. Let me tell you how deeply sin is ingrained in John Melvin. You know, Brother Rich introduced the story about Shammah. And I want you to think, he's in the hall of faith because he defended a field of beans. If King David had come to me and he said, hey, John, I need you to defend the hill of beans. And there could have been great strategic reasons, great tactical reasons. Perhaps the topography of this bean field was a crucial point in the battlefield. And if you could prevent them from going through that and winning the day there, then you could prevent a further advance. Who knows what the king is thinking? But this is what would be going in my mind. And I promise you, this is true. Seriously? You're king, not me? Seriously? God chose you? Seriously? I mean, what'd you do? Just a little, you know, you got a little slingshot out. You're, first, I'd be irritated that David was king. Second, I'd be like, man, can you give me something where the women will be just going, ooh, John did this. He killed 10,000 Philistines. Nah. Then they'd be thinking, can't you give me something where I can win some glory as opposed not to a bean field? I want to go in history as being the dude that defended a bean field. I want to go down in history as the guy that defended the treasury or the guy that's me. That's how ingrained sin is in me. You know, Maria. And we go through this ritual. Last week, I shared with you some things about Maria's funny little world. I love her to death. I do. We have this ritual on the weekends. She'll say, John, how do I look? Honey, you look gorgeous. You're beautiful. I love that outfit on you. Honey, how's my sermon? It's all right. That's how deeply sin is ingrained in me. So we talked about sin, and James, who's talking to children of God, he says, lay aside the filthiness, lay aside the superfluity of naughtiness. Who's filthy? Who's naughty? I am. All of us are. And it can take forms that we don't even recognize. Okay, well, we talked about sinful acts. Let's talk about sinfulness. Going from sinful acts, individual punctiliar one-time events, to actual sinfulness, the ongoing condition. Because this goes deeper and has to do with kind of our orientation. And the Bible will sometimes talk about these things as sins or transgressions, and then they'll just be listed out. And they talk about sin as deeply entrenched patterns way below the surface, insidious, like a disease that just leaks out when I'm not even trying. Self-serving words. Tones that just come out, even when I'm not even trying to sound promotional. And I don't know how to turn it off. And I don't know how to shut it down. And in my body are jealous attitudes. Chronic ingratitude just crops up. Thoughts that come into my mind. This is what the Apostle Paul says. The things that I would do, I don't do. The things that I don't want to do, those are the things that I actually do. It's just, he's talking about this pattern, and these are just incredibly important words because although they sound kind of odd to us, to understand them, we'd really have to talk about an important subject for a couple of moments. That is spirituality and habits. Habits. Because a habit is a relatively permanent pattern of behavior that allows for you to navigate your world. And the capacity for habitual behavior, it can be really good. It's indispensable to human life. When you learn how to tie your shoes, you do it so many times that after a while, you don't even have to think about it. You can do it blindfolded. Habits are indispensable. But the patterns of habits and the ability of habits to be able to do good things, be able to navigate our world, play a piano, tie our shoe, drive a car, it's hard work, and you just have to get concrete about it. The capacity for those things to be good, they're equally capacity for things to be evil. And I've got kind of a fundamental spiritual truth for us. We are a collection of our habits spiritually. Talking about habits, how many of you who have been married have decided how many of y'all sleep on different sides of the bed that are married? You know, one day you'll sleep left hand, one day you'll sleep right hand side. Nobody. We get into these habits, it's just kind of second nature to us, and we do it without even thinking about it. I don't know why I sleep on the right hand side. I don't. You know, I remember one time, it was a few years ago, I decided, well, I'll try to sleep on the left hand side of the bed. Maria comes to you, what are you doing? You can't do that. Well, you know, my side of the bed has this big dip in it. Your side of the bed's firm now. And she's like, baby, we got to get a new mattress. Habits free us up. A habit's a behavior pattern so ingrained we don't even have to think about it. Without habits, we can't make it through our day. But the most important truth about our spiritual life is we're mostly a collection of habits. That's why other people can pretty much predict how you're going to relate to a particular situation, how you're going to respond. Now, this business of habits, how God made us, and the power to acquire habits, it can be a good thing. But sin has gotten so deep into us, so deep into the ways that I think, the desires that I have, the perceptions that I have, and how I feel and choose and walk and speak and listen and act and behave and relate. Sin has gotten into my habits, and the tragedy is of unspeakable proportions. So the Apostle Paul is making the precise point about this. The good that I would do, I'm not doing. That I don't want to do, I'm doing. And it's not like there's some invisible ghost inside of you that's making you do evil things. What the Apostle Paul says is that one of the results of the fall is not only sinful acts, it's a sinful condition. And while Jesus has conquered sin, Jesus has conquered death, if we shut the General Motors factory down today, we would still have General Motors cars for years to come. And although the sin factory has been killed, sin is just coursing through our veins. And so the Apostle Paul, the New Testament, the writers of the New Testament, primarily talk to us about developing new habits. Don't offer yourself up. Do not offer your members up to sin. Rather, the Bible tells us to offer up our bodies as living sacrifices. Offer up our mind to read scriptures. Begin to think about things like love and joy and peace. Offer your hands up to practice giving so that you can be freed up to be habitually giving. Offer your feet to go somewhere and serve somewhere. Offer your lips up to practice saying good things. I'm paraphrasing, but all these injunctions are given to children of God. The children of God, the gospel is addressing, are all these sick people here. And so Jesus says, I've come for the sick and not the healthy. And your only hope for this sinful condition and this transforming effect of the gospel is not to develop more willpower. More willpower. Your only hope, really, through the power of Jesus Christ, is to develop a new set of habits. One of the confusions about primitive Baptists, because we do believe in the concept of predestination. It's a biblical concept. It's taught three times in the Bible. Predestination, unlike our brothers and sisters in the Calvinist church who believe that there is a predestination to heaven and a predestination to hell, primitive Baptists don't believe that. We were all hellbound. Until God chose an elect people and he died and he saved them according to a sovereign plan. So we don't have that double concept of predestination. We have a saving God who did a saving act according to a sovereign will and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. according to a plan that was set forth before the foundation of the world. Now, that's not me talking. That's Bible, Ephesians 1, 3, 4, and 5. According to He has chosen us in Him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before Him in love, having predestinated us into the adoption of children by Jesus Christ, according to the good pleasure of His will. Our participation in that, zero, not found anywhere. We also don't believe, as some of our brothers and sisters in what's called an absolute church, in the absolute predestination of all things, was not predestinated. Sin is not predestinated. People are predestinated to heaven. That's the only biblical use of that concept. We do have providential events being occurring in the Bible, where events are talked about providentially. But the fact that today you get in your car and you blow your horn, or you get in your car and you drive home, it's foreign to say that that is a predestinated concept. It's not. So we have a destiny that has been predestinated. The events that are transpiring right here on this earth, those are not. We've been given an amazing amount of liberty on this earth. That's why in Colossians, when the Apostle Paul is writing to the church of Colossae, he says, if you be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above. The prerequisite to seeking the things of Christ is to be risen with Him. So what does that tell you? There are people that are risen with Him who are not seeking, and that's why Paul's saying, seek, seek, seek. It's not so you can earn your way into heaven. It's so that you can actually become one of the healthy people, because Jesus came to bring healing, and through His power and through what He offers, you can go from a state of a very sick child of God to a very healthy child of God. And the only way to make that transition from sick to healthiness is not to be a couch potato Christian saying, oh Lord, just bring it to me. Zap me with some healing. It's actually get out there, roll your sleeves up, get a little bit muddy, get a little bit dirty, and start working at it. You're not entitled to your healthiness. I know that's kind of shocking in our healthy therapeutic culture, but we're not entitled to it. We actually have to work at it. Because your sinful condition is something that we got. Thank you, Granddaddy Adam. And now we're dealing with the results of it. Jesus Christ took care of the ultimate result, the destiny. But for today, that original sin, the Bible says, Book of Romans, that sin entered the world through one man and death through sin. And in this way, death came to all of us. So everybody is kind of spiritually dead. And God, through His sovereign act, through to His family, He gives them spiritual life. And then He says, okay, you got spiritual life. Now let's move you from you 2.0 to you 3.0. I want you to go from this state to this state. I want you to transition from here to here. And the same thing that raised you from the dead is the same kind of power that you're going to have to rely on in order to get healthy. Jesus is the answer to all your questions. Jesus is the answer to all your problems. And that's why we preach the gospel. Because in the power of gospel, healing comes to people. As a matter of fact, when Jesus starts His ministry, over in chapter 9, it said that Jesus went into the temples and He started preaching the gospel and healing all kinds of diseases and problems. There is this conjunction between the gospel being preached and healing transpiring. And if you are in a church, your spiritual life needs to be getting progressively better. Or the church is not teaching the truth, or you're not doing your part. But there is an individual responsibility on the child of God to go out there and do the things that God has wanted them to do. Because I can promise you this, you can be a sick child of God. It's a painful thing for pastors to see. Something intrinsically broken about us that only Jesus can fix. You know, and we're coming to the conclusion of the sermon, but and we always have to struggle, and I like to remind us as a church every now and then about maintaining an appropriate attitude towards sinfulness and sinful and sick people. We always have to fight that tendency to feel like we're morally superior to anybody. And I'm not talking about non-Christians too. Morally superior to the Christians living a bad lifestyle, morally superior to non-Christians. Because the Muslim child of God, the Jewish child of God, is just as sinful as the Christian child of God. We are all sinful. 6 billion some odd people on this earth, maybe 7 now, Every single one of us. There's none righteous, none, not one. The only hope that any of us have is Jesus Christ. That is a permanent disease that we are all afflicted with, from the youngest person in this congregation to the oldest person in this congregation, and to everybody outside these walls. We did not earn heaven. Jesus did. We did not earn it. Jesus did. And his righteousness is imputed to us as his children. He was the only hope. And I can tell you this as we come, because sometimes struggling against sinful attitudes and sinful things like that, sometimes it gets kind of, you know, it is such a common everyday occurrence. It can seep into us at any given moment. And I had an experience about a month ago. I had to give a talk. And have you ever had one of those experiences where, you know, you had to give a talk or a presentation or something like that, and you just got supernatural power? I mean, it was just like this otherworldly power where you're just invigorated at just the right moment to give one of those things. This was not one of those times. I felt like doggy dirt, and I felt like doggy dirt when I was worse than doggy dirt. And I was driving home, and I was just, ah. Oh. And all of a sudden, this verse came to mind, and it says, and it was Jesus, and Jesus says, "I no longer call you a servant, but I call you my friend." And I don't know why that verse meant so much to me at that moment. But the very concept that I didn't have to do anything at that moment, because I'm trying to read my Bible through again this year, every couple of years, just read it cover to cover. That I didn't actually have to go home and have this list of things that I had to do, that I'm not a servant anymore, that my relationship with Jesus is far more than what I do. My relationship to Jesus, I'm not a servant, I'm a friend. And that brought a measure of happiness and relaxation that I hadn't experienced in quite a while. And this is what I want to say to you, as fellow strugglers against sin and sinful attitudes. Get off the performance train and enjoy the relationship that you have with Jesus, not as a master and a taskmaster and a list of things of you do and you do not do. Enjoy your relationship with Jesus because he is your friend. And greater love hath no man than this, that he laid down his life for a friend. Jesus died for you. He paid for those sins. And now what he's saying to you is, friend, I want to help you get better. I don't care what sin you're struggling with, because there is no sin that you've committed that God says, "Oh, I didn't know that about you. You really went there? You thought that? You voted that way? Whoa, hey, let's all rethink this whole plan from the beginning of the earth, because I didn't know that when the earth started." No, that moment never happens. He knew every sin that you would ever commit. He says to the prophet Jeremiah, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. I framed thee." He knows everything about you. Every sin you'll commit. Every time you disrespect your parents. Every time you're going to hurt a brother or sister. Every lustful thought you had. He knows it all. And he's still your friend. Isn't that the kind of God that we want to serve? Because that's the kind of God that the Bible tells us about. May God richly bless you.